When we are little kids and growing up, one of the things that our parents want to teach us is what is fair, right? There's some things in life that aren't fair. We like to tell our kids an hour's pay for an hour's work. You reap what you sow. You get out of it what you put into it. A day's wages for a day's work. But soon our children learn, and we all learn, that life is not necessarily fair. And perhaps it's not such a bad thing. In fact, Oscar Wilde wrote, "Life is never fair, and perhaps it's a good thing for most of us that it's not. We don't want what we've earned. God is not fair." And that's, we should all say hallelujah at that point. God is not fair. He is just. He is compassionate. He is gracious. But Romans 6:23 says, "The wages of sin is death, separation from God. And if God was fair, we'd all be lost. There would be no hope for any of us." Today we come to a parable that's a little different than the other. The other parables have been more about sowing the good word and the gospel growing and the harvest that's coming. But I want you to draw your attention to Matthew chapter 20 today. And there is a parable of laborers in the vineyard. And this is one of those parables. This is one of those times when the Lord said something and people all said, "What?" And we'll come to that in a minute here. But in order to understand the parable in chapter 20, verses 1 through 16, this is one of those places where a chapter division actually makes it harder to understand. Because if you just start at verse 1 of chapter 20 and read the parable and do not know the setting of the parable, then you already could have a bad understanding of it. So we need to look back in chapter 19. And when you look at chapter 19, you'll see that there's a couple things there. One, there was the rich young ruler that came to Jesus. And he came and bowed down to Jesus. He came to the right place. He came and did the right thing. He bowed to the Lord. And he wanted to know what he had to do. And Jesus played along with him a little bit and said, "Well, what are the commandments? What do you think you need to do?" And he said, "Well, there's this," and he named the commandments. And Jesus said, "Well, that's right." And he said, all of these I've kept from my youth," which obviously couldn't have been true. But Jesus didn't accuse him, didn't condemn him at that point. He said, "There's only one thing that's missing in your life." Can you imagine? That young man must have been pretty excited. "Just one thing? Oh, wow. That's all I need." Jesus said, "Go sell everything you have and give it to the poor and come and follow me." And it says that he got a long face. Literally, that's what the word means. His face dropped. And he went away sorrowing because he had much goods, many goods, much riches. And in the light of that, Jesus began this little discussion with his disciples. In verse 23 of 19, you can pick it up there. It says, Jesus said, "I tell you the truth, it's hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. I'll say it again, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." Now, it's kind of interesting because people have tried to explain that. Well, there's a gate in Jerusalem that's very small, and it's called the Eye of a Needle, and a camel would have to kneel down and go through it. Actually, I think what Jesus meant was it's impossible. It's impossible. In fact, that's what they said. The disciples were astounded, and they said, "Well, if rich people can't get saved," because obviously rich people are blessed of God, "then who can be saved?" And Jesus said, "With man, it's impossible." So he interpreted what he said. It's impossible, but with God, everything is possible. And then Peter came up with a question that really this parable has more to do with Peter's question, but the setting was all about riches and all about goods. And Peter said, Peter was always the spokesman, you know, for the, he said the things all the others were thinking. And he said, "We've given up everything to follow you. what will we get? Not a good question, is it? We've given up everything to follow you. What will we get? Jesus began, first of all, assuring them that they will get much. You know, if you've given up anything on earth, you're going to get 100 times as much and eternal life. But then he said this in verse 30. He repeats it again in 2016. But many who are the greatest now will be the least important then. Those who seem to be important now will be the greatest then. So the first shall be the last, and the last shall be the first. If you drop over into 2016, you'll see that's how he ends the parable. And so those who are last now will be first then, and those who were first will be last. Jesus said, I'm going to teach you something that's going to turn the world upside down for you. You need to understand that my kingdom is not about houses. It's not about riches. It's not about goods. It's not about what we're going to get, as Peter asked. It's about what we have already received and the greatness of that. So that's the background. Let's read the parable. I'm reading from the New Living Translation, chapter 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like the landowner who went out early one morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay the normal daily wage, one denarius, and he sent them out to work. At 9 o'clock in the morning, if some of you have a version that has the third watch and the fourth, all those things, this is what they are. Okay, so at 9 o'clock in the morning, he went back. Probably the first group went out at 6 a.m. That would be a normal start of a working day. He went back at 9, 3 hours later. 9 o'clock in the morning. He was passing through the marketplace and he saw some people standing around doing nothing. And so he hired them, telling them he would pay them whatever is right at the end of the day. So they went to work in the vineyard. At noon and again at 3 o'clock, he did the same thing, hiring people and saying, I will pay you whatever is right. At 5 o'clock, 1 hour before the end of the working day, in the afternoon, he was in town again and saw some people standing around. And he asked them, why haven't you been working today? And they replied, because no one hired us. The landowner told them, then go out and join the others in my vineyard. So now he has people working that started at 6, some that started at 9, some that started at noon, some that started at 3, and some that just started an hour ago at 5. That evening, he told the foreman to call the workers in to pay them, beginning with the last workers first. And when those hired at 5 o'clock were paid, each received a full day's wages. They received a denarius. Then those who were hired first came to get their pay. When those who were hired first came to get their pay, they assumed that they would receive more, but they too were paid a day's wage. And when they received their pay, they protested to the owner. Those people worked only 1 hour, and yet you paid them just as much as you paid us, who worked all day in the scorching heat. And he answered them, friends, I haven't been unfair. See, there's the word. I haven't been unfair. Didn't you agree to work all day for the usual wage? Take your money and go. I wanted to pay this last worker the same as you. Is it against the law for me to do what I want with my money? Should you be jealous because I am kind to others? So those who are last now will be first then, and those who are first will be last. First thing that we need to understand, and that's why I gave you the background, is that this is not a parable about salvation. It's not about working to get your salvation. No one can earn salvation, okay? It's not a parable about rewards. Now, there'll be rewards in heaven? Yes, but it's not very clear exactly how they'll be portioned out. You know, we have all these cute stories about the preacher getting there and he gets a little shack in the corner and the taxi driver gets there and he gets this big mansion and the preacher says, wait a minute. What's that all about? You know, I preach the gospel, I get this little shack, and he drove a taxi, and he gets this mansion. And the St. Peter said, well, look, when you preach, people went to sleep, but when he drove, they prayed. Silly stories like that really don't give us a good picture of heaven. We don't know what it's going to be like. Jesus said, I'm going to prepare a place for you, and when it's ready, I'll come back and receive you, that you'll be with me. And right there is all that we really need to know about heaven. It's a place that Jesus prepared for us. He knows exactly what we want. And it's a place where we will have fellowship with him. That's heaven. You know, it's nothing about gold streets or diamond or pearl gates. The pearl gates always make me wonder a little bit. I always wonder where that oyster is that made that gate. I don't want to find it. It sounds like something out of a science fiction. Well, this is a simple story, isn't it? A simple, normal life story. There are no miracles in this parable. There's no Old Testament quotes. It's not something that the prophets said before. There's no heavy theological terms. There's no hidden terms. If you look up what it means to pay, it means pay. Hire, it means to hire. And there's no really outward blatant sins. Now, we come to the end there. We see that those workers had a sin problem in them, but there's no blatant sins. But there are some unique things about this. Any landowner had vineyards where he hired people to work for him would have had a leader, a foreman who would have gone and done the hiring. The landowner himself would not have done that. So it was kind of unusual that the landowner did the hiring. And he repeatedly went into town and hired more people. Now, we don't know anything about we do know that when the grapes are ripe, and if there was a storm or something coming in, it was important to get them off the vines at a certain time. If you talk to wine growers or you talk to vineyard people, they say there's a certain time that you want to get those off just when the sugar's at the right peak. And so maybe it was one of those times. He needed to get his harvest in quickly. All we know is that he just kept hiring people all day long. Now, basically, there are two groups here that he hired. I mean, I know there's four, but there's basically two. The first group was the people that he hired at the very beginning, and they agreed to a price. So if they might not have had a written contract, wouldn't have stood up in Germany. You have to have a written contract. But they had a verbal contract. They had agreed to work for a certain amount. And by the way, the amount, denarius, it just calls it a full day's work here, a full day's amount. It was actually what the Roman soldiers got. And Roman soldiers were paid much better than common laborers. So it was not a measly salary. It was a very generous salary that they were receiving. But they agreed to it. I mean, they were happy. Yes, we'll go to work for you. And they agreed to that. And then those hired at 9 a.m., 12 noon, 3 p.m., and 5 p.m., they didn't have a contract. They didn't have an agreed amount. The statement was, go and work in my field, and I will do whatever is right. So the first group had a contract, agreed price, and the second group had a trust. They didn't know what they were going to be paid at the end of the day, but they trusted this man that he was going to pay them what was right. So they might think, well, half day's wage, that would have been right, or a third day's wage. So then comes the part where things get turned around. The landowner said, let's pay everybody. And that was by law from the Old Testament. Workers had to be paid every day because they maybe didn't have enough money to buy food for their family. So every day, at the end of the day, they were paid. And so that wasn't an unusual thing. That was a normal thing. And he started with the last group. They'd only worked an hour, and he gave them a full day's wages. And you can imagine those who worked from 6 o'clock, their minds begin to roll. Ah, see, they only worked an hour, and they got one denarius. We're going to get 12 denarius. And then came the next group. And they worked from 9 o'clock, and they got the same amount. And so those who were calculating their minds said, well, yeah, I guess that doesn't matter. We won't get 12. Maybe we'll get 9. We should get 9 because that would be fair. And then those who came at noon, and they got the same amount. And, you know, up to this point, those who got hired at 5, at 3, and at noon, they're rejoicing. You know, there's not a one of them that's upset. You know, like, wow, look at that. He paid me a whole day's salary here. I can feed my family and have money to do something with. That's wonderful. And so they were thinking, and now maybe we'll get 6. Then those who were hired at 9 o'clock came, and they got the same salary. And so the ones that worked all day long, they said, "Well, hey, if we get 3, it's okay." So, and those amounts would have been fair. I'm not great at math, but you can figure that out. They would have, you know, figured 12, 9, 6, 3, and so they got paid. What did they get? 1. They got the 1 that they agreed to work for. And so notice what happened here is they began to grumble, it says. And actually the word is in a continuous tense, so they began and kept on grumbling. You know how that starts, doesn't it? You know, it starts with each other. You don't immediately grumble at the landowner, but you say, "Hey, did you see what happened there? You know, we got 1. They got 1, and they only worked a little bit compared to us." And the grumbling began and growing among them, and this unrest grew. And finally, one of them at least said, "Well, hey, let's go talk to the landowner. You know, we got cheated here." And they began to complain to him, and they complained. And they said some interesting things. First of all, they said, "You made them equal with us." Interesting. Weren't they all laborers? Equal in what sense? You lifted them up. What were they saying was, "We're actually better than they are. We worked more and longer than they did, so we are actually better. And you brought them up to our level." That was their first complaint. And then notice how they dramatized it just a little bit, you know. "We not only worked all day, but there was scorching heat." You know, that never comes up before here. But now they're making their case, okay? "It was scorching heat. It was hard work. We worked really hard out there. And it's not fair that they got paid what we got paid." But the problem is their heart was revealed, wasn't it? What were they really concerned about was not that the landowner was greedy. I mean, they're getting what they agreed to. He's not a greedy man. He's not cheating them. He didn't take, too much taxes out or anything. That's not what they're complaining about. What are they complaining about? He's generous. He's good. What an interesting thing to complain about. Ecclesiastes 5:10 says, "Those who love money will never have enough." Sounds about right, doesn't it? Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. How meaningless to think that. Ecclesiastes 5:10. Look at his answer. I like the way the landowner answered here. And of course, the landowner here is a type of God, type of Christ. And he says to them, he didn't say, "You ungrateful dogs, get out of here." Did he? What did he say to him? Look at the verse there. He said, Friend, I haven't been unfair with you. I mean, I gave you a job. I hired you. You were my first choice. You should be rejoicing in that. And I did what I said I would do with you. I've treated you as we agreed. It was a generous wage. And then he says, if I want to do something good for the others, it's not unlawful. There's no law against it. And it's certainly my money. I can do what I want with it. His answer was very clear. And then he began to point out the problem. He said, "Your evil eye," that's the literal translation there, "your evil eye, you're envious of others. You're not complaining about my greed, you're complaining about my generosity." And what we see is we see a spiral downward. And I want to kind of point out the parts of that happens, because I think It's easy for us to get caught up in an attitude like this. It's easy, and we need to be aware of how it happens. First of all, there was a lack of appreciation. Do you notice that they didn't say, hey, by the way, we want to thank you for giving us a job? Not a one of them. There was no appreciation. And if you read in Romans chapter 1 and read about the spiral away from God down to the very depths of sin, you'll see that the first step is that they knew who God was, but they did not thank him. Did not thank him. And when you or I get into that place that we stop thanking God and stop being grateful for him, be careful, you're on the wrong path. You're on the wrong path. The next step that happened was there was pride. They began to compare themselves, right? We are better workers. We worked longer. We worked harder. We, you know, got through this terrible hot day. We deserve more. We're better. Better people deserve more, right? Isn't that true? We sometimes get caught in that, don't we? Better people deserve more. And then they began to compare, you know. They didn't do it. Look what we did. Look at the comparison here. 1 Corinthians 4:5 says, do not be quick to say who is right or wrong. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring into light the things that are hidden in men's hearts. He will show why men have done these things. Every man will receive from God the thanks that he should have. We should be careful about comparing ourselves with one another. I love the story of the little boy who came running in and to tell his parents. He said, Dad, I've really grown. I'm 6 foot tall. And his dad looked at him and realized he was only about 4 foot tall, 1 meter instead of 2 meters. And he said, well, that's interesting. How did you come to that conclusion? He said, I made my own meter stick. I made my own measuring. And that's what we tend to do, don't we? We make our own standard. Well, I'm better than they are because of this. You know, I'm not so good in that area. But over here, I really shine. So that's the measurement that I want to use. And they compared themselves. Romans 12:3 says, because of the privilege and authority God has given me, I give each of you this warning. Here's a warning from the Lord. Don't think you are better than you really are. Be honest in your evaluation of yourself. Measuring yourself by faith God has given us. What is it that should be the measure in our life? It should be our faith, not our talents, not our efforts. Our faith is the only measuring place. It calls for a sober estimation. In the King James, I think it says that. And I always like that phrasing. Make a sober estimation, an honest estimation. And then notice that comparison leads to what? Coveting. They were coveting. You made them equal with us. You gave them more. He didn't give them more, did he? Gave them the same amount. But in their eyes, when you compare it, it looked like they got more because they didn't work as long. And then came a complaining spirit. Philippians 2:14 says that we're to do all without complaining. And the complaining spirit became a critical spirit. And when you fall into that trap, then nothing God does is good enough. Nothing God does is good enough. Well, yeah, we live in a nice country, but, you know, we could have better weather, Lord. You know, the snow stuff coming in and out, that's not very good. And we complain about everything. Nothing is good enough when you get a critical spirit. It doesn't matter whether the Lord gave you cake and ice cream. You would say, well, actually, I wanted a different flavor of ice cream. You know, we begin to complain about everything, sinking into sin. And then notice that grace is scandalous. It's scandalous. You know, it's not fair. In terms of the world, it's so strange. But grace is God's very nature. You remember when Moses said to God, I want to really see you. I want to know all about you. And God said, Moses, you wouldn't last. You couldn't see me really face to face. So here's what I'll do. I'll put you in the cleft of the rock and I'll hide you and I'll walk by and you'll see me from behind. And as I go by, I will proclaim to you who I am. And in Exodus 34:6, the Lord passed in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth. If you have to describe God, those are the words you should use because those are God's words. This is how God describes himself. I am compassionate and gracious. Compassionate. I don't think, if you ask the typical people, even people in churches, you know, could you describe God? What's the first thing that comes to our mind? I'd ask you, but I know what you're going to say anyway. Almighty. Isn't that how we think of God? He's magnificent. He's a great creator. How did God describe himself? I'm compassionate. I'm compassionate. I am gracious. And it is his very nature to be gracious. There's Old Testament examples, abounding Old Testament examples. Abraham, we've been going through Genesis and on Monday nights, and we've been looking at Abraham, the father of the faith, you know. Keeps lying about his wife. No, she's not my wife. She's my sister. Even when she's 90 years old, he's lying about who she really is because he's afraid somebody might want her. She must have been a beautiful 90-year-old. That's all I got to say. And yet, Abraham is the father of the faithful. Look at David. David was a mighty king in many ways, but David committed adultery. And to top that off, he had the man murdered, who was the husband. And yet, God says, he's a man after my own heart. Grace. Let me give you another example, because I think this is an interesting one. In 2 Chronicles, if you want to turn there with me, 2 Chronicles chapter 33, I want to just read a few verses there about King Manasseh. 2 Chronicles 33, because we need to look at the beginning of this man's life. 2 Chronicles 33, and I'm going to read verses 1 and 2. Get there. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. So we could kind of say, well, he was so young, you know. And he reigned in Jerusalem 55 years following the detestable practices of the pagan nations that the Lord had driven from the land ahead of the Israelites. He made pagan worship the center worship for Israel, the worst thing that he could have done. But he wasn't satisfied with that. Look at verse 6. Manasseh also sacrificed his own sons in the fire in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. He practiced sorcery, divination, witchcraft, consulted with mediums and psychics. He did much that was evil in the Lord's sight, arousing his anger. Can you imagine? God had chosen Israel to be his holy nation. He had delivered them. He had provided everything for them. And here's a king that says, no, we're going to worship all the other pagan gods. And he went to the ultimate. He even sacrificed his own kids to them. Now look at verse 10 through 13. The rest of the events of Manasseh's reign, his prayer to God, and the words the seer spoke to him in the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, are recorded in the book of Kings of Israel. Manasseh's prayer, an account of the way God answered him, and the account of all his sins and unfaithfulness are recorded in the record of the seers. It includes a list of the locations where he built pagan shrines and set up Asherah poles and idols before he humbled himself and repented. When Manasseh died, he was buried in his place, and his son became the next king. At the end of his life, after he had done all this wickedness, it says he repented. And he turned to the Lord, and God in his grace forgave him. There's lots of experiences in the Old Testament. Jonah was very upset with God that he was gracious. Remember, God said to Jonah, I want you to go and preach to Nineveh. And Jonah ran the other way. And we often say, oh, Jonah was afraid to follow God. No, he wasn't. You know, God got the whale and got him turned around and got him going in the right way. And he went and preached, and the whole city repented. Great revival from king on down. They fasted and prayed, and God forgave them. And then Jonah said, he prayed to the Lord, isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? That is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Notice how he described God? Whose words? God's words. God's words. You are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, abounding in love. He said, I ran away because I knew if I preached to these people and they repented, you would forgive them. And I didn't want you to forgive them. I wanted them to be destroyed. I wanted fire to come down from heaven. When you get to the New Testament, James and John, blessed James and John. You remember what their nickname was? Anybody remember? Sons of Thunder. And how did they get that name? Because they wanted God to rain down fire on people. Lord, they rejected you. Sick them, you know. Bring down the fire. God didn't do that. In the New Testament, examples abound. The prodigal son's older brother. God had blessed him, and the father went out to him and said, everything I have is yours. And he wouldn't come in and celebrate because his brother that had gone off into sin had come back and been forgiven and accepted back into the father's household. You find that story in Luke 15. Zacchaeus, it says, we love to sing the song, was a wee little man. And a wee little man was he, and he climbed up in the sycamore tree for the Savior he wanted to see. You see, I was paying attention in Sunday school. I learned all those songs. And when Jesus came by, he said, looked up in the tree, and he said, Zacchaeus, I want to go to your house. And when he went to his house, Zacchaeus got up and said, Lord, I'm going to give back all the money that I cheated. If I've cheated anybody and given it back, I'm going to follow you. And all the others, righteous people, complained. Jesus is eating with that tax collector. That was worse than a dog in their terms. He was a traitor to them. He was the lowest of low, but God saw his heart and he was forgiven. Saul himself was one that was out to destroy the church and destroy the early believers. He was on his way to Damascus to put some more in prison. He wasn't satisfied doing it at home. He wanted to go to another land and find believers and put them to death. And God struck him down, and God changed his heart, and he became Paul, who wrote so much of the New Testament. Are there modern days examples? Yes, there are some, and some of them are very troubling to people, very troubling to people. In America in 1991, they discovered a man had systematically, over a number of years, had killed men, and cut them up and disposed of their bodies, although he kept some of their bodies. He had eaten. He had done horrible things. I'm not going to mention most of the things he did. His name was Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer. And when he was finally arrested and put in prison, there was a pastor, Roy Radcliffe, that began to talk to him about Jesus Christ and talk to him about giving his heart to the Lord and asking for forgiveness. And in his last interviews, if you can find them, this is all recorded and all put on tapes. He asked for forgiveness. He asked people to forgive him for what he did. And this pastor wrote a book called Dark Journey, Deep Grace about his conversion. And there were people. When it was announced that Jeffrey Dahmer was converted and going to heaven, there were people that said, no way. If he's going to heaven, I'm not going there. If there are people like that, people who have systematically murdered and even ate the bodies of other people, I don't want to be a part of that. Why would people say that? Because of that sense of fairness within us. That sense of, okay, I'm better. But the truth of the matter is, you and I are no better than Jeffrey Dahmer. You see, in God's eyes, there aren't big sins and little sins. We're all sinners. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The wages of sin, not bad sin, but sin, is death. The wages of sin. And we stand, we like to stand up a little higher, you know, like, oh, Jeffrey Dahmer, that awful sinner, look at him. Look how good I am. I didn't kill anybody so far. I you know, I'm not like him. And God says, wait a minute. You're just like him. You're on the same level with Jeffrey Dahmer. And you need grace if you're going to get into my kingdom. And that's what this parable is all about. It's about the fact that we need to be careful that we don't lift ourselves up and say, well, yeah, but I'm so much better than others. I mean, if you look at the history of mankind and look at the horrible atrocities that have happened down through the ages, almost all of them, are because one race or one group that said, we're better than the others. And they lifted themselves up. And horrible atrocities. You know, there's not a nation that isn't tainted by it. You know, if people say, well, yeah, but our nation never did that. Yeah, every nation did that. When the Americans moved into the West, here were all of the tribes out there living decent lives in most cases. And they were literally rounded up and pushed into places where they couldn't even live until they died. It was horrible things. And down through history, it's happened again and again and again and again. We were in, when we first came over to Europe, our second vacation, we went to Yugoslavia. You all know. You youngins know what Yugoslavia was? Yeah, because it's gone now. It's not there anymore. And in Yugoslavia, it was a nation that was kind of forced together. Okay, it wasn't really ethnic one. In fact, there's seven nations now where Yugoslavia was. But they lived together under force for 70 years. And one day, when that force looked a little bit weak, people literally went next door and cut the neighbors' throats because they were of a different group. A different group. When I was in Yugoslavia, I couldn't tell any difference between Croats and Serbs. They all looked the same to me. They used the same money. They went to the same schools. And yet, in a matter of weeks, that happened. People were literally killing each other. And they couldn't even, I often wonder, how did they even know who was who? Names, mostly, was it? The Tutsis and the Hutus down in Africa lived together for years in a nation that was considered one of the highest percentage of Christian nations. And then something flared up and their hearts were stirred and they went out and killed each other just because they were not of the same tribe. It's happened over and over and over again. And you say, wait a minute, are you comparing us to that? Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Because if we stop thanking God for all that He's done for us, we're on that slope. If you stop thanking God every day for all that He has done for you, and you start lifting yourself up in any respect, you're on the way to where all of those people were on the way. And we need to be careful with that. What are the lessons of grace that should be learned here? First of all, God is sovereign and gracious toward all. There's no favored group. Now, the Israelites were favored for a purpose. They were chosen to bring Christ into the world. And today, there are some that say, well, Israel's still a special place. It is in the plan of God. I like what one man wrote. Israel is God's timepiece. And when we see things happening there, we will know the end of time is there. But are they better people? Are Israelites better? I don't even know if there's any Jews here today. If you're a Jew, I'm not trying to offend you. Are they better than other people? No, they're not. And in fact, if you want to know who the true Israelites are, the true tribe of Abraham today, read in Galatians that it's believers. Believers are really the ones who are following in that step today. God is sovereign. He calls us personally, and he gives us not what we deserve, but what he has already paid for. You see, the idea of the landowner going and making the hire, that's a beautiful picture, because that is God himself. He's the one that calls us personally. He never once, you won't read it in the scriptures, and you won't hear it from God, that he says, hey, you. Yeah, you over there, come here. He knows us by name. He knows everything about us. Yes, he knows those bad things about us as well. And yet he calls us because of his grace. And he doesn't give us what we deserve. Praise God. He gives us grace. Everyone who serves him will be treated with grace. We always receive better than we deserve. You know, I don't think we need to worry. I don't know if Peter was worried that somehow he was going to be overlooked. But it kind of revealed his heart, didn't it? Yeah, what are we going to get? What are we going to get? I've heard a few preachers that kind of tended to sound that way too. Well, I'm a preacher. I preached the gospel for years. What am I going to get? The Bible tells preachers what they're going to get. Harder judgment. That's Paul says, don't desire to be an elder, because elders will be judged a little bit harder than others. Sorry, Thomas. That's the Bible's very clear on that, what preacher's going to get. Extra judgment. So everyone who serves will be treated with grace and will get far more than we deserve. There's no question about that. And thirdly, God desires for you to respond to his grace. How does he want us to respond? How should these people have responded? They should have responded with thanksgiving. They should have come to him and said, thanks for choosing us first. There were others there, apparently, that he could have chosen. If you became a Christian as a young person, then you should be rejoicing for all the pain that he has saved you from. We had a children's program in one of our churches, and sometimes little kids, they say, well, I don't have really good testimony. I used to feel that way as a teenager. We would go, and they had these Christian films, and there was this guy that, he was an awful guy, and he did all kind of bad things, and then right at the end of the film, he got saved. And I thought, wow, what a great testimony he has. I don't have a testimony like that. I never robbed one bank. I should go out and rob a bank or something. I never did this. I never did that. And so we had a program one time. We had these little kids, and they had little signs, and they came up, and they said, I thank God I've never smoked a cigarette. I thank God I've never robbed a bank, just all kinds of things like that. Thank God. If you started early, thank God. If you were saved later in life, thank God that he didn't give up on you. He didn't give up on you. He doesn't give up on us, does he? Because if you're normal Christian. I don't know if there is such a thing as a normal Christian. But you've gone through some ups and some downs in your faith. And God doesn't give up. He just keeps pulling you back. Why? Because he loves us. Serve him with love and with diligence and faithfulness. Rejoice over his grace in the lives of others. These guys had a chance, didn't they? They could have said, wow, we're really happy for you. You got a job at the end of the day and you got paid. Man, that just shows you what a good guy we work for. So they didn't do that, did they? They missed it. When somebody comes to faith later on in life, we should rally around them and have a party. Why? Because they do in heaven. The Bible tells us that, doesn't it? There's a party in heaven when someone comes to faith. And we should do that as well. Rejoice over that. This whole parable says God is not fair. God is grace. Let's rejoice in that. Let's not forget to thank him day by day, not forget to rejoice that others are coming to faith. Not forget how good our Lord is. May the Lord bless you.